Good morning and welcome to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here in the United States. And we make that distinction because we do have international listeners and regional listeners and people beyond the signal range of this live broadcast. If it's live for you, if you are in the Medford, Somerville, parts of Cambridge, parts of Boston, unspecified area that this signal goes out to, emanating from Tufts University. And we are WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, Tufts Free Form Commercial Free Community Radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And again, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio for the next 2 hours with myself, Jeff, and
Diego.
Welcome. And you're going to hear some weird noise here because we're having a little technical difficulty. We're going to share a mic here. That's the way it goes. Anyway, so welcome. We are, like our tagline says, that's the official word for it, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Today's show, we have sort of alternative news, which you might expect from a show like this. But we also are a little different from all the other shows on the left spectrum of the dial, you know, all those college stations. We are an unabashedly pro-democratic socialist, and we don't mean Democratic Party there. We mean democratic socialist in terms of how decisions are made in a socialist society and in the movement for socialism. So we are democratic socialist. We are for a fundamental transformation of power and control from the super rich and the big corporations to working people.
Other words, bringing democracy to the workplace. That's real socialism.
Yeah, bringing democracy to the economy, as a whole, the workplace on an international scale. And we are, that's what we're about. And we're just a modest little slice of what is a movement below most people's radar, but is growing, actually. Attitudes towards socialism are improving tremendously in the United States. Polling data. Recent polling data from different sources has shown that not just around the Sanders campaign and the label he had as a socialist, which really wasn't true, but he didn't at least disavow it. He just tried to redefine it into liberalism, which is unfortunate in its own right. But
see, as you mentioned,
well, let's.
I don't know. I was like, sometimes at night I put on the 6:80 a.m. on the dial, and it's just all this right wing, blah blah blah. The whole thing is just right wing. But then you hear this, Sam, being a socialist, not that's pay kind of well, doesn't he? He's got a new over there, a new mansion, and blah blah. They came on him about the mansion, and I was thinking the other day about who's that guy, Jeff, that goes like, nothing's too good for the working class. Tell that story.
Yeah, there's a great story from labor history, socialist history. One of the leaders of the IWW, Big Bill Haywood is his name, nickname, or in his real name, Bill Haywood. This is worth a little digression here, and then we'll get back into what we're going to talk about today. But Big Bill Haywood was leader of the Western Federation of Miners, and he was a miner himself and was elected as president of his union back in the early 1900s, and he became also one of the leaders of the International Workers of the World, which was a movement for one big union, radical union movement with socialists and anarchists and others in it. And then he became a communist. He, like the best of the IWW leaders and many of the rank and file, the minute the Russian Revolution happened, they saw that that was the way to go. Try to do like the Russian Revolution, successfully overthrow capitalism in a, at least initially, nonviolent way, fairly, because they were so well organized, the capitalists just couldn't keep control in Russia. It was only the invasion of imperialist armies funding and maintaining this thing called the White Army that turned into a civil war. That's when a lot of violence started in the Russian Revolution. And the Russian Revolution initial success, was a shockwave across the left internationally, including here in the United States, and people like John Reed, Big Bill Haywood, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, and Mother Jones, and and many others went and joined the Communist Party, right? So getting back to Big Bill Haywood, he was harassed mercilessly for his radicalism and his socialism and communism and so on. And one day the media surrounded him, and Haywood didn't shrink from taking them on. And they said, "Hey, Bill, we noticed you're always smoking those fat cigars. What's that all about? You're doing pretty well for yourself, huh?" And he took a big puff and blew smoke at all the journalists all the corporate media whores back then. He said, nothing's too good for the working class. And I love that story. Yeah. Well, the Sanders mansion is actually a bit inflated, I think. From what I've read, it was a house, granted on Lake Champlain, which is nice, a little cold, if you've ever been up to that lake. But it's just more or less a house, and not even a second house. Apparently, they sold the house they were living in and moved to another one for a price that around here would be cheap, actually. Up there, a little expensive. Like, I think it was like $400,000 or $500,000 or something like that. So, you know, I'm not apologizing for Sanders. I mean, he did a terrible misdeed to the left by pretending to be a socialist, running in the Democratic Party. Big mistake. But what I was just mentioning, and I know you know this, Diego, I'm just saying that, like, the fact that they labeled him a socialist, they red-baited him at first. It didn't work. He didn't give in to it. That was a positive thing. And the fact he didn't take any corporate money, although he does at other times, again, double-edged sword, but we're kind of positive. So, you know, the polling data, like I started to say, for socialism, before Sanders, during Sanders, after Sanders, keeps improving. Meaning there's amazing statistics from polls where the majority of people of color view the word socialism favorably. The majority of millennials, 18 to 29, I believe it is, view the word socialism favorably. It's only when you break it down to like white workers or something, or white people or something like that. I don't even know if they make a class distinction, that it dips, but it doesn't dip as far as you'd think. It's like still around 30%, 35% favorable. And that's like, wow, you know, that's, you know, with all the Cold War rhetoric, which I still remember, and I got over it. So I'm sure you can, not sure everyone else can. If I got over it, I got a thorough brainwashing in anti-communism as a young boy, you know. I had an older brother, who was in the Vietnam War as a Marine. Now, he never said anything to me about it, but, you know, anti-communism or anything, but that was the media narrative. You know, we were fighting communism and all that. I got over it pretty quick myself, because I could never, you know, as long as they keep you away from socialism, as long as they keep you from checking it out, they get away with the propaganda and the right-wing radio, you know. And it's true of, like, far-left people, too, like anarchists. I'm like, okay, you're an anarchist. I used to be an anarchist for a short time in high school and a little bit afterwards, maybe. And but, you know, when I started to work and I was in a union, I found those ideas useless. And I started learning about socialism. I found those ideas very helpful, that methodology very helpful. I mean, really, for Marxism or socialism is really a method of analysis and a guide to political action. It used to be called scientific socialism when it first started, right? That's what it's about. It's not a closed system. It's not a bunch of ideas to memorize or something. It's a way of figuring things out, and not just in the abstract to figure out what's going on, but then what do you do about it? So it's particularly good for, you know, politics. It's also good for science and other things, but it's good for politics. And if you're interested in improving things, that is, if you want to destroy everything or something, that's something else. But if you want to put power in the hands of the vast majority, real democracy, that's what socialism is about. Real democracy, bring democracy to the economy, and bring democracy to the workplace, including the workplace. But anyway, the rest of the show today, we're going to really talk a little bit about the new issue of Socialist Alternative, hot off the press, issue number 26, September 2016. We're going to talk about a tour of a British Marxist coming around, you know, the United States, and talking about the need for socialism and why it's a particular opportune moment, important moment in history for building the forces of socialism. Even though there's no mass movement out there, no country you can point to as socialist, and that includes Cuba, by the way. I don't mean that. I'm not saying that at you. I'm just saying it. And
last summer, I'm like, oh God, they got more restaurants in this place than, you know, in the United States. This is going backwards, you know.
Well, you know what I heard yesterday, and the reason we're talking about this, Diego has relatives in Cuba, has been to Cuba many times, and I heard the number of flights they're going to start down there is 30 a day or something like that from the U.S. I mean, it seemed like a lot. Maybe that's not that many.
They've opened the Trojan's horse.
Yeah. There's still, among some American leftists, a real kind of fondness for Cuba, especially I was talking to an older gentleman who is a really good socialist, I think, but he just happened to grow up in a time where Cuba was the thing, you know, and there was potential for it to become socialist, although how you'd have socialism in one island, much less one country, is, I think, impossible. And that's part of what Leon Trotsky and other people talked about. Trotsky's Permanent Revolution is really worth reading about that. But anyway, or Revolution Betrayed, anyway, by Trotsky. The point is that there is an American part of the American left, especially some of the older, you know, very good Marxists, but in a lot of ways, but they have a soft spot for Cuba. They don't put a rigorous analysis on Cuba and say, well, you know, that's not workers' democracy. It's not going to be able to survive economically on its own. They don't want to look at what Raul Castro is doing with the so-called reforms.
They didn't look at the materialistic situation of an economy that relies on subsidies from the Soviet Union. It's like if this country was getting subsidies from China, and let's say China fell, what would happen to the economy? You know, just put it in that analysis.
I agree totally. You're absolutely right. You know, and that's part of the scientific socialist part of it. It's like, and I understand it too. I think, I mean, I don't want to do too much psychoanalyzing or whatever it would be, but if you've been fighting for socialism your whole life in the United States, which is one of the toughest countries to do that in a way, then you just see any little incremental improvement in the, you know, anything you want to label as socialist as a good thing. So Cuba still exists. It still has some sort of a planned economy. That's a good thing. And in a sense, we would agree. In a sense, you know, the fact that it's not totally under the control of U.S. imperialism and capitalism is a good thing. But they're getting their hooks in. Like Diego said, they're getting their hooks in. They've opened it's the gift of development in the Trojan horse of repression and exploitation. And it's not going to work, basically. The so-called mixed economy has proven to be a failure in every place from Venezuela to wherever. Yeah, you either go for... you know, if you really want to study the history of socialism, you have to study the regimes that patterned themselves after Stalinism, which was a mistake, but they did. They got rid of capitalism successfully in many countries in Africa and Asia. And yeah, because they were patterned after Stalinism, they had inherent weaknesses in planning and decision-making. They weren't democratic enough. They weren't spreading the revolution internationally enough. They were too nationalistic and all that. But on top of that, they had to face imperialism. They had to face the might of capitalism militarily and economically around the world. And they got buried, some of them very quickly.
Yeah, look at like situations in the 50s in Guatemala, for instance. And then you have Iran would have been different, had the Shah. I mean, the guy that was, who was a socialist or the guy that was more of a democratic.
I'm going to mispronounce his name. It's Mossadegh, I believe, 1953, I think it was, in Iran. And that's a great example. He was like a Chavez figure or others that, you know, they were on the, or Allende in Chile, they were socialists, they were on the, well, I'm not sure Mossadegh was a socialist, but they were on their way to, they were on their way to some sort of socialist society, or so the people that voted for them, many of them thought, and they ended up chickening out, basically, and I don't mean that in a simplistic way, I mean that with all the complexities involved, they never tried to mobilize the masses of people for a revolution. You could include Mitterrand in France in 1979 or 80, I believe it was, maybe 80, as late as 81, a socialist/communist government was elected in France. A lot of people don't know about this. And it was the culmination of a movement that really started in France 68, you know, and you finally had the left somewhat united, that you had them elected into power. They had the majority in the legislature, I believe, in France, and they could have the parliament or whatever, and they could have done whatever they wanted. And they did start along the road. They nationalized the banking system. That's a huge start towards real socialism. And however, they're trying to use the same old capitalist state. That's not really socialism. Socialism wants to have a workers' government, not a capitalist state. And for reasons that are very practical, you know, how are you going to organize people to defend the gains that you're trying for? How are you going to make decisions? And based on a capitalist state, you have a lot of intervening unappointed, unelected officials. You have the army, the old army, the old police, everything. So the capitalists in France, let's take the example of Mitterrand, they just said, hey, you're doing these things we hate. We're going to go on a strike of capital. We'll refuse to invest. Where are you going to get your money from? Where's the state going to get its money from? We'll leave the country. And that's kind of a interesting threat, because for some of them it would mean they would lose a lot of money. I would call their bluff on that personally. Mitterrand didn't, right? He blinked. He started to undo all those all those reforms, and then just further sullied the name of socialism, further brought it down to a lot of people, to what Bernie Sanders wanted to define it as, basically liberalism. So now you have the Socialist Party in France is ruined, and it had, you know, and it was kind of before that as well, but I mean Mitterrand kind of buried it. So now you have a guy named Hollande in there who's just really not really a socialist, calls himself one.
Who's the guy, the socialist that became like social democrat, that Kautsky, is it, am I pronouncing the name right?
Well, there's a whole millions of them, not millions, but I'm sorry, there's many of them. Kautsky, yeah. Kautsky was when social democracy started off, that's like a broad term for parties, socialist parties that started off to be revolutionary. And they got a certain amount of success around the turn of the 20th century, around the 1900s. And a lot of them kind of abandoned socialism. They were able to get elected to parliament. They were able to make their peace somewhat within the countries with capitalism, or so they thought, you know. So, for example, in Germany, became the largest socialist party in the world before World War I. And they were getting a lot done in terms of reforms, but they weren't, at a certain point, as many other Marxists, including the ones in Russia, that were really more serious about socialist revolution, they said, well, you seem to be only talking about socialism in broad, abstract terms, and even then, not that much, and talking more about, you know, the reforms that you're able to get or whatever. And there's a way to merge reforms that are needed with the struggle, putting forward the struggle to socialist revolution. That's what the transitional program, for example, is about, that Trotsky wrote, for example. I'm mentioning Trotsky a lot because he had the experience of seeing the Social Democratic parties and the Stalinist parties come into being and really set socialism back in a lot of ways. But anyway, back to the Social Democratic parties. World War I was the defining moment. A lot of the leaders of the big Social Democratic parties, including Kautsky in Germany, ended up supporting their own countries in World War I. And that went against internationalism, which is a basic fundamental principle, but also methodology of socialism. You can't build socialism in one country, get the resources necessary for socialism. It has to be an international effort, just like capitalism is international. You can't have capitalism in one country either, really. But they use nationalism to stay in power. It's a contradiction of the capitalist system. It causes a lot of war and a lot of other problems. But to see the biggest socialist party in the world have the leadership say, or a portion of leadership, like Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht didn't go along with it, but to have Kautsky and others say, yeah, we're going to support the German war machine in World War I, and then other countries do the same thing, the leaders of socialist parties, it kind of took away the whole revolutionary roots of social democracy. So social democracy continues after World War I, and that was the sort of defining line. If you're a social democrat, it basically meant you weren't a real socialist. And if you were a Marxist or you know, socialist, like in Russia, then you were a communist, in other words, then you were a real socialist. And that became the difference. Now, the funny thing is social democratic parties still exist today. I don't know if funny is the right word, but... and they're thoroughly, you know, for the most part, pro-capitalist parties. But...
Portugal has one.
Yeah, but depending on what's on offer in various European countries, you still might see people have illusions of the Social Democratic Party, and that's happening in Britain right now. Even though the Labour Party in Britain is a reformist political party, it's not revolutionary. Way, way back in its founding, it did have things in its constitution about socialism and needing to take over the economy for socialism and so on. But even then, it was clearly a Social Democratic Party and became that. It stayed that way. Sorry about that. I didn't lower my phone for the show, and I will do that right now. So anyway, the Social Democratic parties, you know, still exist in some forms, and depending on what's happening, people might get reinterested in them, and that's what's happening in Britain right now with Corbyn, who is kind of a left-winger. I mean, he's more left-wing than Sanders was. Still, I'd say ultimately a reformist, but still to the left of like Sanders and the Democratic Party and all that. And the Labour and the Social Democratic parties tend to be left to the left of the Democratic Party in the United States, unless they're totally, totally sold out completely and totally, totally under the control of big business, because some of them still aren't totally under the control of big business. They still get their money from the labor movement and so on. So in Britain, the Social Democratic Party would be the Labour Party, but it still gets most of its money from the labour movement. It gets money from workers that can actually join and be members. Unlike the Democratic Party here, you can register as a voter, but you can't be like, there's no membership really. And you also can be involved in, depending on how much they're bringing back of the old structures that were destroyed in the 80s and 90s by the right wing, you can actually join groups in your area and vote on Labour Party candidates and policy. It's complicated because the courts and the right wing of the Labour Party are trying to stop that from coming back. So anyway, my whole point is just that, yeah, social democracy long ago gave up socialism, including Kautsky and the German Social Democratic Party, and the communist parties became more left wing. But now then you had Stalinism, and now it's really like you mentioned Portugal, great example. So out of the betrayals of the communist party influenced by Stalinism and the betrayals of the old Social Democratic Party, the Socialist Party, which is just like very considered very safe now. Like actually right-wing workers will vote for the Socialist Party in Portugal. Doesn't mean anything, really. They have a left bloc. They have a party called the Left Bloc, where a lot of the smaller left parties join together. And that left bloc is, I think, done fairly well. I'd have to check on what it's done recently. But it's gotten some people elected and so on. Sort of like Podemos in Spain. Got some people elected, for better or worse. There's things like Syriza, which ultimately sold out, but it grew very rapidly as a left alternative. Basically, in Europe, there might still be ideas of reforming some of the social democratic parties, but I think it's more like forming new parties. And then those new parties get tested, may fail. I mean, it's basically get to the point, I think, the working class is going to have to get adept at bringing up political parties quickly, testing them quickly, and then filling them out very quickly if we're going to get anywhere. We don't have the luxury of decades of development anymore, you know? And it comes to a head really quick. It's the power of capitalism through globalization, you know, more intense globalization than existed earlier under capitalism, through using things like the World Bank, the European Union apparatus, the European Bank, Central Bank, and all that. They're testing those so-called workers' governments right away. They're like, oh, you say you're socialist? Boom, we're gonna withhold money. So then the government is faced with a simple choice. Just like Mitterrand, just like Kautsky, just like Allende, you go to the people and you mobilize. You mobilize militias instead of the army, armed militias. You mobilize the people into Soviets or workers' councils, whatever you want to call them, and you go to war. It's a civil war. You go to war with capitalism, you know, and you spread the revolution internationally. That's your only choice. And that's a hard road to do, but it's the only choice. And if you firmly believe that capitalism has no future, that's even more the only choice, you know, and they don't take that choice. They get comfortable. They think they can. I mean, even Chavez, you know, Chavez considered a hero by many poor people in Venezuela. But when you step back from it all, he wanted to go some sort of middle road. He didn't want to do that ultimate mobilization of the people to take on capitalism.
And they killed him. I really seriously believe they killed him. That's just my feeling about it. We'll talk about that in the news. But anyway, I had a question I totally forgot. So Jeff, take it. Sorry, I'll think about it again. Hold on.
No. If you remember, go ahead. Yeah. Just jump in. But in our, you know, with our limitation here, but you know, I need to actually. This is kind of funny.
That's what it was.
Oh yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So you know, we'll talk about the IMF. I don't know if people are aware of BRICS. You're aware of BRICS?
Yeah.
What's your feeling on that? BRICS is basically Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. So this is like the counter to the IMF for developing countries. What's your feelings on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the BRICS have had their day. It's actually moved on because after the 2007-2008 economic crisis, including here, the deepest recession since, here in the U.S., deepest recession since the 1930s, that was the big hope. I remember reading for like a couple years after that, hey, don't worry, all these other countries are developing, right?
La Rouge people are talking about it big time.
Even now?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's hilarious because...
They got away from, let's get our guy in there, you know, politics, but we're going to just promote the BRICS thing, you know, look at the alternatives or whatever of the world.
Well, that's kind of ridiculous because, first of all those economies are capitalist. Even China's sort of a state capitalism, and it is state capitalism in my opinion. And they all like after they were promoted as alternatives and ways out of the financial crisis, they started to crash. Brazil, deep recession now. Russia, I don't know exactly if it's in recession, but it's not. It's a very weak economy. India, the same way. China, definitely going backwards in a lot of ways. Even GDP is still in positive territory, I believe, but it's very weak. And South Africa, major troubles in the economy. So every single economy that got singled out as a way forward was not a way forward. And it was really what's happening. The most you can say that's happening in a country like India or even South Africa is that there's a layer of the population that's getting wealth, relatively speaking. They're not becoming rich, but they're upper middle class for the first time. And that impresses the hell out of the bourgeois here, the upper middle class and the upper class here. They're like, oh yeah, they recognize that as development, quote unquote. But the fact that the tens of hundreds of millions are barely surviving means nothing to them. You know, as long as they have a ruling class or an aspiring ruling class they can rely on and lean on, that's great, and they'll propagandize the hell out of that. But even the corporate media, even the corporate economists and so on, the pro-capitalist economists, a lot of them are saying, gee, these countries are in trouble. All so-called BRIC economies are in trouble, and they are. And then they look at the U.S. and they say, hey, the U.S. is doing pretty well. Now, we live here. we work here. We know it's not doing too well, you know? They can talk all they want. I mean, it reminds me of all the recent booms they had, the IT bubble of the late 90s, the housing bubble in the 2000s that led to 2007, 2008, or triggered it at least, post-war upswing ending in the 74, 75 recession. You know, I lived through all this stuff, and for me, it's been one downhill slide. You know, I never benefited from any of these things. I could see, there's only one time I could see people actually kind of getting a little ahead, and it wasn't a good thing because it was all crazy, fictitious capital based on the wonders of the internet that were not proven yet, the IT bubble. I remember just happening to know people, maybe it was just the circles I was in at that time, through a girlfriend I had who were going to these jobs at the new startups, the new web pages and stuff in the late 90s or 2000s, doing nothing and getting paid enormous amounts of money and going out to dinner every night and having a good old time. And I thought, well, I'm not experiencing that. And I know a lot of people aren't, but there's definitely a layer that is. That crashed within 2 years, man. That went down fast. And they all went scrambling, man. I guess I'll become a lawyer now. And then they go to become a lawyer, and everybody else is becoming a lawyer. And law schools are overfilled, and you can't find a job when you get out of law school, and so on and so forth, you know.
Student debt on top of it.
Oh, God. Now it's a student debt bubble they're talking about, you know, because it's trillions of dollars with a lot of promises at the end that aren't going to be met by capitalism. Capitalism can never give people, the vast majority of people on the planet, not to mention the vast majority of people in any country, even the United States, richest country in the world, and you have 47% of the population that can't come up with $400. This is a fact from a recent Federal Reserve study. They can't come up with $400 for an emergency unless they borrow it or sell something for it. So as a result, you have the same old credit card debt, same old student debt, all that stuff that, you know, we've been talking about for years. It's just intensifying and getting worse, you know, and more people are getting poor. I was watching just yesterday this guy, this idiot from Marketplace on NPR, but he was on TV. There's a PBS station called The World or something. I don't know if you ever saw that. And they had these graphics about the shrinking middle class in the United States. Now, the first thing about it was that it was completely silly. Middle class from there, you're not going to believe this. For an individual, it was $24,000 a year to $70,000 or $80,000 a year, something like that. Dude, that's a huge freaking gap, man.
I don't consider myself middle class. I'm poor.
Well, hey, if somebody made $80,000 as an individual, not a household, not with their partner, if they're married or whatever, they're doing well. They're doing really well. They're really kind of, they could still be working class because they have to sell their labor and everything, but they're doing really well. The term middle class is meaningless. It's working class, and then you talk about, you know, where you're at in that spectrum. You know, yeah, I'm still selling my labor. I can't afford to quit. But if I'm making $80,000 a year, I might be approaching that time where I could like pluck some away and quit or something, or 100,000 a year or something like that. Then when they got into the real figures you usually hear when you hear about income, they're talking about household income. And that's usually two people's income. Sometimes it's more, sometimes is it less? Yeah, I guess it could be less. But usually it's two incomes, right? So household income sounds a lot higher, and a lot of people, since they don't even say that in a lot of articles, believe it or not. If you're trying to read economics in this country, it's very sloppy. So the corporate media will put out a statistic about household income, about income, and they won't say it's household income. So everyone thinks that they're talking about individuals. Like, what, 125,000? Who the hell's making it? You know, you can walk around thinking everyone's making 125,000 a year, and they're not, all right? So hardly anybody is. And it's not people's fault, but the math involved in incomes is just like, it would make your jaw drop if you really understood it. And I'm not saying I understand it fully, but I'm just, if people really understood it, they would just be shocked at how little they make compared to a tiny, tiny minority. They make a lot, lot more. So anyway, back to the household income. They're talking about median household income, and median household income is still really low, actually, compared to what it is if you know what the statistic is. In other words, if you think it's an individual statistic, that looks high, because median household income is around 50,000, right? But again, they don't label it household income, so a lot of people think that's individual. So they think there's a million people running around, or millions and millions of people running around making 50,000, or tens of millions, whatever. And but then if that's all of a sudden household income, that could be $225,000 incomes, or a 30 and 20, and we're also talking gross income. So you take after taxes, what's the actual net income? I personally lose $15,000 a year in taxes, and or over that in taxes and deductions for medical insurance and dental insurance, stuff like that, for my family. So again, household income versus individual income, gross income versus net income, it's all a big game, you know. And you look at the figures for household income. Median household income, median means sort of the halfway point, then it's really low, actually. If it's more than one income you're talking about, then you look at the one income figures, and middle class is 24,000, really? In Boston, can you live on 24,000 unless you have a special arrangement, like you live at home? And, you know, anyway, it gets crazy. Hey, we're going to take a quick break here and come back with like what we started to talk about, some kind of alternative news you might not have heard about. Then talk about Socialist Alternative and our new issue of the newspaper, and get into this book review I wrote. We'll see. And then if we have time, we're going to hit the lesser evilism camp again, because they deserve every shot they take, and we're gonna look at that. And also healthcare. If you haven't been following it, what's the official name for Obamacare? Affordable Healthcare Act. ACA, something like that, yeah. Is unraveling rapidly, and the EpiPen thing, where people that have allergies are paying all of a sudden hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a month, every month, to make sure they don't die suddenly from an allergic attack, to get an EpiPen, meaning a shot that will prevent that. That's just the tip of the iceberg as far as what the pharmaceuticals are doing, and it's all linked into the unraveling of health insurance in this country, and we'll get into that too. Right after this, so stay tuned. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO in Medford. America. That was American Idiot by Green Day. I meant to put on Holiday. I ended up with American Idiot. But American Idiot's a good song, too. No offense, American Idiots, but, you know, whatever. It's not our fault. So, Diego's telling me a great story off air. Why don't you have a smartphone, Diego?
Because I have a rugged little flip phone that falls all the time and breaks, and I put it back together, and it works like a charm. It's reliable, and you know what? It does. It's simple. It's a phone. That's all. I don't need a computer, walking around with a computer, you know, being a more radiated, you know, whatever you call it.
Well, that's hilarious because I'm the same way, man. I got the old flip phone. And you know what they told me at Verizon when I got this? You know, they are like, in 2 years, you won't be able to buy these anymore. You'll have to get a smartphone. And I believe them.
I've had this for 10 years already.
Yeah, well, they're killing us. They're killing us. You know, I heard this really rotten... Go ahead.
Also, the battery, I've had this for 10 years. I haven't had to get another battery. If I was to go get another battery, they don't make them no more.
Yeah.
This is lasting like almost a decade. Why would I want to get rid of it? It's actually more efficient than the ones they say today. It's like they were saying it lasts by design, that battery, for 2 years. And then after that, what?
Yep, exactly. And it's, you know, the whole planned obsolescence thing, wasting of capitalism, is just like huge now. And paying for things that we didn't used to pay for. There was this professor on an NPR talk show from Harvard, a business professor, and I really dislike her analysis. You know, it's really kind of bad. It's just embarrassing that professors go and pontificate when they don't know the basics of the economy that anyone can learn. If they're just not immediately biased, if they're not immediately pro-capitalist, they can actually see what's going on much clearer than someone that's, you know, a professor and has hours a day to read and stuff. But anyway, this learned professor was giving a lot of psychological mumbo jumbo about the economy, but there was one good point, which, you know, wasn't original to her or anything, but it was like, okay, we're paying for stuff we never paid for before. Look at and they listed all this like smartphones, computer access, and the way they've organized the capitalists have organized things, supposedly under the name of efficiency, but really it's more like get rid of workers and hope that they can still extract value in various ways. You try doing without a computer hookup. It's really, really hard. Because now, I was just informed by my kid that 70% of his homework is going to be on the computer. He's only in sixth grade. He's entering sixth grade. I was told if I lose my job or my wife loses her job, how do we apply? We got to get on the computer and send out, you know, these idiotic resumes all over, you know? How do you look stuff up? You know, how do you get the weather forecast, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, well, there's TV and radio, but the TV, most people are paying for cable. We're not. But because of the computer thing, you're kind of paying for it, you know, like because they bundle it all. We're not doing cable at all, trying to save money. Anyway, you get the picture. There's just a lot of things that we used to get for free or very low cost because they were heavily regulated, like phones and so on. And instead, it's become a nightmare of stuff you need. And yet, everything's $100. Everything's $200. Everything, you know, every repair now is like $1,000, it seems like, in a house, you know. Car repairs are crazy expensive now. And you need a car. The transportation system hasn't improved in this country. It's gotten worse, in fact, in a lot of ways. And a lot of people need cars just to get to work. You know how expensive it is to keep one or two cars running with insurance costs and everything? It's just insane. Like, and what's this thing in Louisiana, right? All the big tornado. What's the main complaint you hear? I didn't have flood insurance, so I'm screwed. Or I had insurance, and they won't honor it.
Oh, my.
So typical.
Yeah, my aunt has insurance, and she lives in Dallas for tornadoes. It's automatic. You buy a house over there, they don't tell you need to have it. They say, I reckon you better have it. Or something like that, you know, because a lot of tornadoes and...
Yeah, insurance, and insurance is the biggest. Anyone that really has insurance and really has to use it knows that there's this magical thing called a deductible, which just basically means a fee that is tacked onto what you're already paying. So, you know, most insurances now have like really heavy deductibles. So you're paying what you used to pay for just a basic repair anyway without insurance, plus then maybe a little more of the insurance covers, and the whole thing washes out that you're paying between your monthly payment or yearly payment and your so-called deductible, which is just another payment, a lot more than anything you're ever going to get fixed ever, anything you're ever going to get covered ever. And yet you're forced by law to have insurance. You get in deep, deep trouble if you drive around without car insurance, you know? And it is really, really expensive. So anyway, we could go on how the working class dies by a thousand cuts in this country, the richest country in the world. And the super rich get super richier and all that. And that is going to be a current theme, a constant theme in a lot of this. But we're also going to explain on Social Alternative Radio how we're going to change that. And one way to help change that, it's not the ultimate solution, but it's a step along the way, is to unionize, to organize. Workers need to organize. And there's this thing called the National Labor Relations Board that covers, tries to legalize and control legally union organizing. It's actually a bad thing overall, but union leaders just grasp onto any good news from the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. They just, because it saves them, you know, work, saves them organizing a real fight and so on. And I understand that to a certain point. I mean, we'll take what we can get, but this is not going to be the answer to ultimately anything, but it maybe will help organize a little bit. And that is with, for example, this latest decision, one of the latest decisions from the NLRB, is that teaching and research assistants at private institutions of higher education, meaning colleges and universities, they have the right to organize unions and collectively bargain with universities that both employ and teach them. This was apparently not worked out fully, that public universities you could, private you couldn't. So that has changed. And now it should be easier to organize grad students. And there are grad student organizing happening. There's grad student organizing happening in a lot of places. The ruling also emphasized that the aims of the National Labor Relations Act, which is something from the 30s, believe it or not, were broad, to encourage workers to organize and bargain collectively, and that the definitions of employer-employee are broad. As a result, the ruling read, quote, "It is appropriate to extend statutory coverage to students working for universities covered by the Act unless there are strong reasons not to do so." That already sounds a little wishy-washy. Anyway, now this goes along with adjunct professors organizing. So if you get adjunct professors organized, you get the grad students organized. And in a place like Boston, this is really important because education is a huge quote-unquote employer. I mean, there are a lot of people selling their labor to these so-called nonprofit institutions that are actually big businesses. And they're just as dependent on that job like I am. I work for Harvard. Are just as dependent on that job as anyone else to make a living. And to cut off sections of that work and say, oh, you can't organize. Whether it's because, you know, if you even at the great Ivy League schools, which are really horrible, actually, you can walk in the door and your professor with a big name is really a grad student teaching the course, not professor with a big name. Professor with a big name is off doing research or who knows what. Let's see. Anyway, according to this article, the NLRB shifted back and forth over the past several decades on issues regarding who among all the people on a university campus is a worker and thus has the right to organize a union. In a decision in 2000, for example, NYU teaching and research assistants, they were able to organize, it says here, actually. And I guess that had to be... Oh, I'm sorry, here, but then they explained that. But 4 years later, looking at Brown, the NLRB said no. It's an educational thing, not an economic thing. Yeah, right. So they wouldn't let them organize. So now here's another decision. See how we can go back and forth. That's what I mean by it's not a solution. It's a temporary reform that maybe we can use to help organize, which is good news. But anyway, more good news, and this is even better news in a way. But again, temporary reform. Again, a reform that can be taken away and a reform that might be messed up. But Socialist Alternative, which is not just a newspaper, like I mentioned earlier, but an actual organization of socialists around the United States in many different cities, including being in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International, which is a socialist grouping in many different countries, in about 50 countries. Socialist Alternative here in the U.S. has successfully forced the city of Minneapolis to put a $15 an hour minimum wage law up for a vote this fall. So when people go to vote for what evil presidential candidate they want, with the exception of Jill Stein, vote Jill Stein if you're smart, if you're a worker especially, then they'll also get to vote on referendums, including one on $15 minimum wage. That Socialist Alternative initiated this campaign through 15 Now, based on our victory of helping to get initiating a coalition that got $15 minimum wage passed in Seattle with some qualifiers, but it got passed. And overall, and the same thing in Minneapolis, we now have this referendum. Not the same thing. This is a referendum, not a wasn't accepted ultimately.
You remember a couple years ago with Faker Baker?
Oh yeah. Governor, we asked him, what was the question Seamus asked?
Yeah, when Baker was campaigning in West Roxbury, which is the big Democratic Party stronghold there, and Baker's a Republican, and not that it matters because all the Democrats voted for him, most of them are accepting Baker's garbage legislation on privatization and so on. Anyway, so Seamus, a member of Social Alternative, Seamus Whelan, who ran for city council in Boston, put Baker on the spot in front of a bunch of people. So what do you think about $15 minimum wage?
And the cameras.
Baker sort of looks around, and he's got that like folksy voice, little catch in his voice. I think it's okay the way it is or something like that. So I'm like, oh, thanks a lot. Afterwards, I remember those guys came up afterwards. There were actually some union people, I think, supporting him, which was sad. Came up afterwards and said, we're really with you guys. And I'm like, we try to stay as nice as possible. You're not with us if you're voting for Baker. But anyway, here's the $15 hour stuff we were working on. And that passed. That was a non-binding referendum in West Roxbury that passed overwhelmingly, by the way. So, but this is a binding referendum. If it passes, we'll get a $15 hour minimum wage in Minneapolis. Now, here's the inside story, though. And you might not have heard about this outside of Minneapolis, unfortunately. There are many cities that now have some cities that now have $15 minimum wage. Started in Seattle. Actually, the movement started in SeaTac, right next to Seattle. And we didn't initiate that, but we supported it in Socialist Alternative. And then it got held up in the courts. Meanwhile, Shama Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T, look her up, got elected to the Seattle City Council and on a program that included the fight for $15 minimum wage. And as soon as she got elected, even really before that, we initiated this $15 minimum wage movement. And we initiated something called 15 Now. Right now, you can go to 15now.org for more information. And ultimately led a coalition that was successful in getting a $15 minimum wage in Seattle. The inside story there is a little tricky. As the coalition gained power, some labor leaders abandoned some aspects of the demand. So it got to the point where there were provisions on it in Seattle where some people wouldn't get it until years later. Some people would get it right away, some workers. And we didn't like that. We want everyone to get 15 now right away. It ended up, it's spread out. But it's already started to kick in, and it's already helping a lot of people, and ultimately will help even more. And it's a fairly, it basically got the ball rolling for better deals. Although every deal I've read about, unfortunately, there's now this like thing, well, we'll bring it in increments. So I saw the Los Angeles one was the best. I read the fine print. I think even there, and that, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, we should research this more, but even there, I think it comes in increments. So LA got the $15 minimum wage.
San Francisco,
didn't California as a whole get it now, I think? I have to double check that. I should know that because that's a huge fact. Other cities, Richmond, California, before the California thing went in, I think the California thing is real. New York, they messed with it. They being the Democrats, and did it just for some restaurant workers or something like that, which is better than nothing, but again, incremental. So anyway, it's become a big movement you've probably heard about in the Fight for 15, which is, I believe, the name of the, I could be wrong about this, but the name of the SEIU-led coalition, where they go on like these one-day strikes at fast food joints to publicize the whole Wendy's or McDonald's, wherever they go out, to publicize the whole demand. And they haven't successfully in any city, I think, gotten that. I'm not sure. Maybe one or two. And if you wonder why I don't have all this information together, because nobody wants me to. I mean, nobody wants to publicize this stuff in the corporate media. All the stuff I'm talking about Minneapolis here, I had to get through Socialist Alternative. But basically, there are some other things. If you read some Minneapolis papers, you can get some other stuff. But what the inside story in Minneapolis was that, you know, we helped get this going. We're leading this movement. We got enough signatures. We and all the other people involved got enough signatures to get it on the ballot. It was like 30,000 or something like that. And then all of a sudden, the Democratic Party, led and controlled legislature in Minneapolis, said, no, we don't think this is appropriate. We don't want it on the ballot. See you later. Brought it to a sympathetic court. Court said, yeah, you're right. Forget about it. So we thought we had lost, and then we appealed it, in court, and the person that the case was labeled, you know, they label it under one person as bringing this case, was a member of Socialist Alternative who works in a sandwich shop. So it was very appropriate. Socialist who works a low-paid job. Boom. And we luckily won the court ruling that said this should go on the ballot. Now the Democrats are appealing it again to try to stop it. But it's a good example of why you should not buy into lesser evilism, why your assumptions about the Democratic Party are dead wrong, especially in a lot of local places. They do the same austerity measures the Republicans do, the same neoliberal rotten policies the Republicans do. There are differences between the Democratic and Republican parties, but you have to ask yourself, are these differences fundamental? And do these differences always maintain? And the fact is, they don't. Like, let's go back to Massachusetts. Diego, you brought up Charlie Baker, right? He's the Republican governor of Massachusetts. So how does he get anything passed? Because in the legislature's completely, overwhelmingly Democratic Party. And yet, all of a sudden, there's all this stuff coming down the tubes to privatize aspects of the MBTA. That's union busting. That's taking away good community jobs. Now they're into charter schools, raising the cap on charter schools. This is corporate welfare. This is our tax money going to private businesses to do schools where they can pick and choose the students and they can make money off it through taxpayers, but not be held accountable the way a regular school can. In fact, in Massachusetts, there's a whole Save Our Schools movement that wants to stop what Baker is promoting and some Democrats, which is a referendum. I think it's question two. Lifting the cap on charter schools. There's already $400 million being wasted on charter schools that could go to public education. They want to make that more. So we urge a vote no on question two, by the way, throughout the state and of Massachusetts. And you know, that's just another example, though, of Democrats cooperating with the Republicans, if you want to put it that way. But reality is they're initiating this stuff with the Republicans, or they initiate it on their own. The Republicans are completely out of the picture. Look at New York. There's not a Republican in sight, really. I mean, there are here and there in upstate New York, but I mean, the real power is downstate New York and the Democratic governor, Democratic legislature, and yet they're doing the charter school, privatized school thing. They're doing a half-assed fake 15 thing. And in fact, that can actually lead to this self-promotion here, and I apologize profusely for that, but I would like people to consider reading this book, actually. And that is Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank. I have a book review of this, very short book review, on in the latest edition, just hot off the press, of Socialist Alternative Newspaper, which we'll get into a little more in a second. And the book I reviewed is called Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank. And Frank is, unfortunately, a liberal. He should listen to himself more because he has no solutions. He doesn't even put forward a third party, any kind of organizing a progressive workers' party or anything like that as an alternative to basically is a whole book trashing the Democratic Party, and rightly so. And he also has a lot of like old Cold War prejudices and stuff. He'll put in a throw-in line about, you know, the Soviet threat or something, and I'm reading that. I'm like, really? You're still saying Soviet threat? You're such an idiot. But anyway, where he's not an idiot is he is just a disappointed true believer. You know, he went from Republican when he was younger to Democrat and really thought the Democrats were the way to go, and now he's disappointed in the Democrats. Now he's afraid to look around. He supported Sanders, but even, and you know, for us, Sanders is just a Democrat, right? Or for me. But you know, raised good issues and so on. Worth talking about. I thought I'd see about a little more about Sanders in this book, right? Despite all the limitations of Sanders. And Frank this book was published back in like the spring, I believe. And he had already determined that Hillary would win. And he doesn't bother talking about Sanders, even though he supported Sanders. He just says, you know, Hillary's going to win. Boom. It's her turn. And he meant that in a very cynical way. He goes, it's her turn in the book, quote unquote, meaning that it's all rigged for her. And so he should have got even more, you know, power, fighting juice or whatever. He should have been even more angry about that. But he doesn't really get into it, doesn't really talk about Sanders. But what he does talk about that's really worth it is going back and really dissecting some of the worst policies of the Clinton administration, goes into Hillary herself. And best of all, just what we were just talking about, there's two whole chapters called The Blue State Model and Liberal Guilt, G-I-L-T. where he talks about places where the Democrats are in power. And I'll quote myself here, which is really, really stupid. The two best chapters in the book are The Blue State Model and Liberal Guilt. The Blue State Model examines state and cities with a Democratic Party lock on state government through long-term control of the state legislature, focusing on New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Chicago. So there's a city thrown in there. And I think he looks at Boston, too. He does look at Boston, too. Frank shows the same national Democratic Party policy of austerity for workers, corporate welfare, attacks on public sector unions, privatization, etc. They repeat locally in these Democratic strongholds. So it's really worth reading to get your armor up, get your weapons up about lesser evilism, against lesser evilism, which of course is flooding the dinner table conversations, if anyone has time for dinner anymore, workplace conversations, you know, like that. You were just telling me about a couple where you work, right?
Conversations with my bosses,
yeah,
you mean?
They're promoting Hillary, you said, right?
One is, and the other one has no choice because he's scared of Trump because, you know, they're from India, so he's scared of the whole, you know, and he's Muslim too, so it's like, yeah, can't, you know.
Well, that's the whole thing, scared of Trump. I'm hearing that from everybody, not just people of color at all. I mean, and the whole thing is that I hate the word scared because it makes you like into a powerless victim. I don't kind of like that phraseology, but let's stay with it. Scared of Trump. Yeah, I'm scared of Trump too, if you want to look at it that way. But the way to beat Trump and the right is not more right, because that's what Clinton represents. Clinton doesn't represent an obvious racism, but an institutional racism. So the way to beat the right is to organize politically against the entire right and provide an alternative to the right. Otherwise, everything shifts to the right, shifts to the right, shifts to the right. Look at Obama. Deported more people than ever before. And until this election cycle, when Trump did his racist anti-immigrant stuff, people were pissed at Obama. Immigrant rights groups were organizing like crazy against the Obama administration, and rightly so, because there's tens of thousands of people languishing in detention centers. And there's more deportation than ever before in the Obama administration. And people were rightly focusing their anger on that. And now it's like, oh, we're just afraid of Trump, we'll vote for Hillary. Some of them. I'm not saying everyone falls for that. And that's wrong. Because this problem is going to be there, even worse maybe, with the cover of a Democratic Party administration. And that's a typical conundrum, a typical dilemma in American politics that Frank actually in this book, List Liberal, does talk about, that if you have a Democrat in power, most of the NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that get their money from the same rich people the Democratic Party does, they will cool down. They will chill no matter what the Democratic Party is doing. So Clinton could come in and get rid of welfare as we know it, destroy federal welfare, except for maybe like food stamps, a couple other things, dump everything on the states. And then there's states now that won't play the game. They won't give anything. So people are much worse off now than they were under the Clinton administration. You know, poor people that are in need of public assistance. It's much worse than it was under the Clinton administration. Now, if a Republican had done that, you would have seen people on the streets, most likely, by groups that are NGOs that are for public assistance and social welfare and so on. But I remember quite clearly when Clinton did that there were some people in Social Alternative even that were predicting this is going to be a mass, all the homeless groups and all the, you know, pro-homeless groups and the liberals are going to be out there protesting. But Clinton was in power. They didn't do anything. There were no protests or almost none. And we were wrong. I mean, I never believed that. So I was in Social Alternative, but I didn't believe that. Some members of